No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Marie Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBS RadioOne. Today we have a very important and timely guest, Dr. Adam Lankford from the University of Alabama. He is here to discuss his book, The Myth of Martyrdom, which deals with what drives suicide bombers, rampage shooters, and other self-destructive killers. So call in with your questions and comments. Again, the number is 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us. Before I go any further, let me introduce my co-host, Marie Sanchez, joining us from California, where I assume everyone is still reeling from the massacre this week in San Bernardino. Hi, Maria.
That's an understatement, Michael. Welcome. Yeah. Thank you for that. And it's affected us on so many levels. First of all, we have family in the area, many of us. And then everyone realizes now that any city is vulnerable. It's not just some big event. It's not just some international occurrence. It can happen anywhere. And I think that's what's humbled us the most, is that if it can happen there, it can happen anywhere. So I'm really looking forward to our discussion with Dr. Lankford about this. And we'll get to that as soon as you do some of your housekeeping.
Yes. I mean, yes, I really think you hit the nail on the head, Maria. More than anything, this event has brought this home to all of us, even those of us on the East Coast. But before we get started, just a little housekeeping. We have a new co-sponsor for the New Columbia Admission Act this week. So we now stand at 128 in the House and 18 in the Senate. And we'd like to send out thanks to Representative David Price, a Democrat from North Carolina's 4th District. So thank you, Congressman Price. And that's it on my front.
Okay, so let me introduce Dr. Adam Lankford. He's a criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama, and as you mentioned, he's the author of The Myth of Martyrdom. He's the author of two books, and he's published articles in numerous peer-reviewed journals. Pardon me, I should be speaking better today. He conducts research on many types of social deviance and criminal behavior, including mass murder, mass shootings, terrorism, and sexual assault. He has received his PhD and his master's in justice, law, and society from American University in Washington, D.C., and his bachelor's degree in English from Haverford College outside Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Lankford, welcome, and thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate your time.
Sure. It's nice to speak with you.
So before we get into some of the details about your book, because what really drives suicide bombers, rampage shooters, and other self-destructive killers, as the subtitle is, what is your take on what happened this week in San Bernardino?
Well, certainly there are a lot of, you know, different elements we could talk about or try to disentangle with this this most recent horrific attack. You know, I think it was interesting the narrative where, you know, early on there were questions, well, is this a workplace shooting or is this terrorism? And actually that kind of corresponds with one of the things in my book, which is, you know, I began looking at suicide terrorists and then realized that they often had certain things in common with mass shooters and rampage shooters as well. So when it came to the attack this week, you know, I think people started saying the word hybrid, that maybe this attack was both, you know, of course, a mass shooting in terms of the nature of their behavior, but also inspired by terrorism. And I would just add to that, you know, in terms of motives, we wouldn't just say it's just a matter of a radical ideology on the one hand, or personal problems and mental illness on the other, that it certainly could be both of those as well.
And the question that I have is, if the couple were radicalized, when and where and how did that happen? Were they influenced, do you think, by Islamic material online or direct contact with extremists? Or does it matter?
I think it does matter. The FBI is, you know, certainly looking into that in terms of their investigations, both in this country, you know, looking at all the documents, the internet behavior of the suspects, and looking abroad at anyone they may have been connected with. So why does it matter? Well, most importantly, it matters in terms of thinking about what the next threat might be. So if these people were essentially the pawns of ISIS or another organization abroad, then you want to make sure that organization or those people are stopped and can't influence, you know, other Americans in this direction. But I think, you know, right now things are leaning towards the idea that this was so-called self-radicalization. In other words, that the two individuals, both in terms of online material, stuff that's in the news, and perhaps the woman, her living overseas, may have, there's some indications that she may have been radicalized in a way that actually made her stand out as different from people who knew her abroad.
Well,
I'll ask my final question before the senator pitches in with his.
Right.
The Myth of Martyrdom, your book, do you understand something about this woman who's a mother, that her radicalized views trumped being a mother to do these heinous acts?
Yeah, well, that is a shocking element here. In other words, she essentially abandoned her daughter, right, to do this.
Right.
And, you know, I guess I would have to say, when you look at other examples of women who committed suicide attacks, you know, that kind of thing does happen. And, you know, part of the myth, you know, the myth is this idea that it's purely about ideology, you know, that it's just commitment to ideology, that if she abandoned her daughter, that the reason for that would be because she so cares so much about serving God or serving her cause. But the reality is that even people who are extreme in terms of their ideology, even people who care everything about the cause, and in fact, other female terrorists would not just abandon their children like this. So that suggests that something profound was wrong with her on a much deeper level.
You know, Doctor, the thing that impressed me most, the thing that I thought was so important to get you on the show, is that so few people are talking about this. You know, we're talking about, it seems to me, all the physical characteristics of the attack and the victims and the other things that have gone, how horrific this is and how many people were injured and killed. But we're not talking really about the motivation. And I don't know if that's because it's so scary to talk about that. I think that originally that idea that we didn't know whether this was a workplace-related thing or a terrorist thing, there was almost a sentiment that we hoped it was a workplace thing because the alternative was so scary. What do you think about that? Why don't we discuss this more? What motivates these people?
Well, I think you're right that we did hope that it was a workplace shooting. That somehow makes it simpler, right, because it's not connected to anything other than that person's own struggles at work and perceptions of mistreatment, perhaps. I think fear is part of it, but I also think, you know, human psychology is so complicated, and sometimes, you know, people don't want to get into what's complicated and difficult to perceive about these attackers. And I think the best way to illustrate that for your listeners is to think of this cliche, and you know, this cliche has been around for decades, you know, this saying where someone does something horrible and the press goes and they interview their neighbors and the neighbors say, oh, I couldn't believe this happened. So-and-so was just a normal boy, you know, or a normal girl, right? And this idea that the real problem here is that people with significant mental health problems and significant personal problems and significant you know, hatred in their hearts can appear normal, and we can only get past that idea, you know, that they're normal by really doing a close inspection. So just as one example, you know, you may be familiar with this attack. I'm sure it was in the news in Chattanooga this summer. There was an individual who struck military sites. You know, both crashing his car and shooting in Chattanooga and killed people there. Well, the same thing happened where, and we saw the same quotes with friends of the attackers this week. But in the Chattanooga case, they interviewed the teachers, they interviewed the family, and people said at first, they said, well, he was completely normal. I saw him laughing in my classroom, you know, a couple weeks ago, those kind of things. And then only later, after people dug into his history and his writings, they found out that he'd been struggling with suicidal tendencies. So, you know, this is a country that has, you know, we are a country that have 34,000 people die from suicide every year. So our ability to recognize mental illness and self-destructive behavior that's in the making, you know, is far from you know, very precise at the moment.
Well,
so Dr. Lankford, tagging back to a comment that you made earlier, is that could she have gotten radicalized before she got here? But then that opens up the question, did the counterterrorism authorities miss those warning signs before they approved her visa?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very reasonable question. And at least the indications I've seen from some of the people who interviewed acquaintances of her overseas suggest that maybe she was radicalized overseas and then came into this country that way. You know, but I guess, you know, we still have a little bit of a tricky thing, which is even if she had radical views, you know, I don't think the United States is in a at least currently in a position where we say anyone who has radical views can't come into this country. You know, in other words, there are a lot of people who have extreme views of a variety of types, you know, left-wing and right-wing, who live in this country and have a right to their opinion. So it's possible that she was radicalized in a sense overseas, but that, you know, we didn't know and couldn't really be expected to know that she'd be a violent threat until this week.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that comment, Doctor, leads me to my very next question. I think that that's one of the things, the problems that we have, and it's certainly a problem I have with understanding this, is that for some kind of perverse reason, we understand the guy in Colorado Springs walking into an abortion clinic where he saw or walking to Planned Parenthood which he saw as the enemy, and this thing that went on in California where there's so many innocents killed. I think that's a hard thing for us to understand, why these people just walk into a crowd of innocent people and do this, where they don't very often seem to target somebody they see as the enemy, or do they see us all as the enemy because of their mental condition?
Right. I think it's an excellent point. In other words, you know, if we were thinking rationally, if, you know, from the perspective of the perpetrator who may hate Planned Parenthood, attacking something you hate makes some sense. From the perspective of the person who attacked that Chattanooga, you know, those military sites, that makes some sense. But why would you attack, you know, these innocent workers? It doesn't make a lot of sense. I agree. And it really, you know, part of the disconnect there is that terrorism has always historically been about sending a message. So you know, back in the 70s, for instance, there were a lot of hostage-taking incidents where demands were made and proclamations made about ideology. And in this particular case, you know, if these individuals were trying to send a message, that message didn't come through at all. You know, they didn't leave a note. As far as we know, no sort of manifesto, no sort of statement that, well, America, you're getting what you deserve. You know, we've seen this kind of rhetoric in the past. They didn't do anything like that. And I think, as you said, this doesn't make sense in part because the logic of the attackers, you know, was flawed at best. You know, I think that's another thing we can use, another sign that they weren't thinking logically either.
Well, what I find exceedingly chilling, though, was
do you think that these people meant to die, Doctor? Excuse me, Maria. I just want to get this out there. Do you think they intended to die, these two people?
Well, you know, there are. It's a very interesting question, and I think here's how I would answer that. Is it self-destructive behavior? Absolutely. What were they consciously thinking? Well, maybe their thoughts changed at different moments. You know, one thing I saw was the CNN national security analyst Peter Bergen said that these were essentially suicide attacks, and I would agree with that. That you know, look, the shooting may have taken something like 4 minutes. I heard. You know, were these attackers so sophisticated that they knew that they could shoot for 4 minutes and then leave before the cops arrived? No. You know, that kind of knowledge was not something that, you know, they had. And then the other thing is, you know, I've looked at these attacks, you know, various types of mass shootings in the United States, you know, and I've looked at them from 1966 to the present, so more than 40 years. And this may be the type of crime that is least possible to get away with. In other words, you know, cases where someone commits this type of shooting and escapes getting arrested or killed are essentially non-existent. We also know that this attack was at least in part planned, that they've been stockpiling weapons. So to answer your question, I'd say, what kind of person plans an attack that is almost guaranteed to end in their death or lifetime imprisonment? And I think you'd have to say someone who doesn't really care much about their life.
I'm sorry, Marie, go ahead.
Also, that I found exceedingly chilling was the fact that that man had been at that gathering and then got up and left some possessions behind and then returned with his wife to kill, as you said, Michael, these innocent people. I mean, talk about a disconnect.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can sit across the table chatting with somebody knowing that you're going to open up fire within minutes.
Right. And I wonder, you know, there was some talk the first couple of days that maybe there was some dispute that he left in an angry manner. You know, the possibility has been raised that he was planning an attack, but he wasn't planning to strike at his workplace until the last minute when something made him upset. It'll be interesting to see what further investigations into his kind of workplace behavior reveal. But I agree, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and it is chilling. You know, generally speaking, I think, even though it's kind of trite, one of the patterns, well, let me give a little context. One of the things we see with a large number, you know, virtually all of these public mass shooters is they feel like they've been mistreated, disrespected, persecuted, and sometimes that's the mental illness that leads them to that opinion. You know, if they're paranoid, schizophrenic, or narcissistic, or something like that. But you know, I work in a university. A lot of universities have been struck by shooters. So I work in a university. You know, as someone who studies these types of crimes, and part of what I do, which could seem trite, is I try to treat everyone with respect. In other words, give them no reason to feel like they've been disrespected or humiliated by me. But as this case illustrates, you know, that's not necessarily any sort of perfect defense. You know, it's definitely good to treat people with respect and try not to humiliate them. But when there are these other factors at play, you know, that's not a perfect protection either.
Well, you know, I find that a really interesting comment that you made, Maria, because it's exactly the same feeling I had about the shootings in Charleston. I was, how could this man sit there for an hour and watch these people pray and be welcomed into their midst and then turn around and commit this heinous crime? Do you know what the disconnect is there, Doctor? I just can't imagine getting, you know, sitting in a group of people for an hour and then turning around and shooting all of them.
Right.
And is this just a coincidence with what happened in San Bernardino, or is it possibly a new trend in this sort of thing?
Well, you know, those are interesting questions. You know, I think if we consider the self-destructive and suicidal element to this, that helps, you know, kind of shed light on the degree to which these people are disturbed and are really in pain. A lot of the times they're in pain. The Charleston church shooter, you know, he did this terrible thing. He'd already planned it, you know, and sometimes men in particular, you know, I say as a man, so I think I'm, you know, criticism is welcome if you disagree, but my sense is that men in particular sometimes psych themselves up to do something that they, and then they have trouble changing their mind or backing down once they realize it's a bad idea. And that applies in a lot of different realms of human behavior, but I think it applies in these as well. In fact, sometimes we see these mass shooters who planned on killing dozens of people. They start shooting, and then they almost change their mind. And in the best of cases, they only wound a few people, and then they actually take their own lives. They just want out. In this particular case, you know, a few interesting details about the male attacker at San Bernardino. The court records from his parents' divorce reveal a few interesting things that they could shed light on his psychology. So the court records from when his parents got divorced show that his mother said that the father had threatened suicide in front of them, and that the father was both abusive and bipolar. So in that context, we can see why, you know, growing up in a house where, you know, his parents are getting divorced, his father is apparently bipolar, his father threatens to kill himself in front of the family, had alcohol problems and was abusive, apparently. You know, some of these problems may have directly influenced the son's desire to essentially end his own life as well, you know, functionally end his own life. We might even call that suicide by cop in this instance.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I wonder about, Dr. Lankford, is that if you're going to try and get, and pardon the stint, like more bang for your buck, why, knowing that you're going to die and go out with whatever infamy comes with that, why wouldn't you hit larger venues and have more damage?
Right. So you're saying, like, why wouldn't he have attacked somewhere where he could have killed more people, potentially?
Yes. Where there's more people gathered, hundreds of people or thousands of people. Because when it's all said and done, not to minimize it, it's a horrific tragedy. But like they did in Paris, you know, they picked huge venues where it would have a big impact.
Right. Well, you know, my sense is in terms of mass shooters, you know, if we just kind of statistically plotted the number of people who died in this incident and compared it with other incidents, this is actually on the higher end. But you're right that sometimes these attackers do intend to kill far more, and sometimes they're successful. You know, one of the things we talked about earlier was the idea that these victims You know, are they considered innocent from the perspective of the perpetrator, or do the perpetrators consider these people as deserving to die? And I think it's really the latter, that the perpetrators, sometimes they do want to kill as many as possible, and they're indiscriminate in terms of men, women, or children, in part because they view, you know, all of society as the problem. So, you know, that is the way that this is functionally similar to terrorism, that both with mass shootings and with classic terrorist attacks, the targets are symbolic and symbolic of a broader enemy and kind of this anti-American sentiment. In a lot of cases.
Well, you know,
that makes sense.
Yeah, and also to provide an answer for your question, Maria, I might have a little different perspective because I live here in Washington, but security here in Washington is very, very tight. I would imagine that security at the event that these people went to wasn't very tight. And, you know, it reminds me of an old joke, which starts out with a crazy person doing something, and then at the very end of the joke, he does something really smart, and the punchline is, I'm crazy, I'm not stupid. And, you know, I think these people are, you know, and very often, and correct me if I'm wrong, doctor, are crazy, but they're not stupid. They go, you know, you're not going to, although we saw a guy jump over the White House fence with a manifesto, you're not going to walk up to the White House with a bunch of automatic weapons or into a football stadium or, you know, some of these larger venues. I think this to me, if I had to guess, I would think it was easy pickings for them.
That's a good point too.
Yeah. And in Paris, you know, I think there was an infrastructure behind those guys in Paris, and there wasn't, I think, you know, again, it's speculation on my part. But at the end, I think we'll find out that these guys really didn't have an infrastructure. It was just, they were self-radicalized, as we're starting to call them.
Right.
So, doctor, what do we do about this? If all of society is the problem for these people, how do we mitigate that?
Well, there's certainly a lot of, you know, different things we can look at in terms of how to stop this. One of the things I did in terms of my research on mass shooters was, you know, I did a global study of 171 countries, and I looked at how many of these public mass shooters they had from 1966 to 2012. And what I found was, first of all, that the United States, despite the fact that we only have 5% of the world's population, we had 31% of total public mass shooters, so far more than our share. And then when I tried to model that statistically to say, well, what explains why we have more and some other countries have more than other countries? You know, the clearest statistically significant answer was, in fact, firearms. So countries with higher firearm ownership rates do have more public mass shooters. It even explains why countries that we might assume to be peaceful, like Finland and Switzerland, why they actually had more public mass shooters than I would have guessed before doing this study. So one of the other interesting elements of this study was that mass shooters in the United States, and the attackers this week are a perfect example of this, are much more likely to use multiple weapons, to have a number of firearms that they load up with before carrying out these attacks. And unfortunately, there's a correlation between using multiple weapons and killing more victims. So it suggests that, you know, anything we could do to prevent the access to firearms, even if these people could still do these terrible things but only had one firearm instead of multiple firearms, even that amount of progress would actually save some lives.
And do you think that the gun issue is a matter of access? I'm somebody that doesn't believe in a lot of guns. So do you think it's a matter of access or acceptance? Is it a matter that these people have access to more guns, or just that guns are such a part of our society that we accept violence as a solution to some of our problems?
Well, that's a very good question, and I can say in terms of the numbers of guns, I think access is the best explanation. So, for instance, I looked at one case just as an anecdote of an angry young man in Germany who wanted to carry out a school shooting, and these are things based on things he wrote online, actually. He wanted to carry out a school shooting, but he complained at one point, "I can't find guns in Germany. Where can you get decent weapons in Germany?" And after he made that complaint, he basically said, "Oh, okay, I'm not going to do this," and he gave up on it for more than a year. And then he unfortunately did find a weapon and carried out an attack, a school shooting. But you know, that particular case study illustrates how, you know, not having the access actually can be a barrier to people doing these kind of things. But let me add to that, in terms of the cultural issue, you know, I'm not someone who, you know, frankly, I studied criminal behavior. So even though we've talked about guns a little bit, you know, I'm not someone who's particularly politically active. I'm plenty busy studying criminal behavior, and I'm relatively moderate in my politics. But I will say, so when I looked at gun culture in the United States, the beginning of that is quite positive. You know, according to Pulitzer Prize-winning historians, you know, the survival of this country, the frontiersmen, who needed their guns to survive, you know, that's an important story, and there's substantial evidence that, you know, early on we wouldn't have won the Revolutionary War against the British. You know, the United States would not exist as we know it if not for our dependence on firearms back then. The dangerous thing in terms of gun culture today is that, you know, according to recent surveys, people still believe that they need to have the right to bear arms to protect themselves from tyranny, from tyranny. So yes. When I look at these mass shooters and some of these terrorists, the scary thing is that they also feel like they're protecting themselves from tyranny. So that's where this kind of cultural thread comes through. They actually feel like they're using their guns in the way they were intended, to fight against oppression, to fight against people who are mistreating them. But of course, you know, so essentially, you know, they're using their guns, you know, in accordance with the Second Amendment in a way that's actually making us all less safe.
But then when you talk about deviance and mass killings and suicide bombers and all, that takes it to another level. So let's just talk about what happened yesterday in Lake Chad. You have girls, suicide bombers coordinated, three different explosions, and I guess the latest count is 28 people are dead and almost 100 are injured. So that has nothing to do with the Second Amendment.
Sure.
And again, right, well, we're increasingly seeing females getting involved in this behavior.
Right, that's right. So, yes, access to weapons is certainly a requisite for mass shootings or terrorism. But the kind of weapons that are accessed vary depending on, you know, what country you live in. So it's very rare in the United States for there to be suicide bombings. And in part, I think that's because, you know, when you talk about these individuals who would carry out violent attacks that might end in their deaths, they don't necessarily trust themselves to build a suicide vest that would function appropriately. Now, overseas, what we see sometimes is that there are organizations who are, you know, terrorist organizations, ISIS, Boko Haram, Al-Qaeda, Hamas. These organizations supply the explosive vests, the suicide bombing belts, to the individuals. So they don't have to do anything to access the weapons. All they have to do is volunteer for the attacks. But what makes that even this issue even more complicated, and it may be relevant to the attacks that you referenced, is that sometimes coercion is playing a huge role in suicide bombings overseas. In other words, sometimes these suicide bombers are really pressured into doing it and are essentially doing it against their will. And that's something that's just been kind of revealed in the last few years. So there were reports just within the last year that ISIS, you know, according to the United Nations, ISIS has been using mentally challenged children for suicide bombings. Because presumably their own members don't want to die, so they're forcing these children to do it instead. Boko Haram, who kidnapped a number of girls, was forcing abducted girls to commit suicide bombing. So sometimes they're volunteer suicide terrorists overseas who have their own problems and want to die and are very much kind of a parallel for suicidal mass shooters in this country, but other times they're almost victims who are being forced to do this against their will. So, you know, either way, it's obviously a sad situation.
Well, you know, I wonder, again, as Maria brings up this point, how much of this is cultural? Because with the exception of this woman in San Bernardino, I can't remember an incident UVA or the attacks in Connecticut or the Colorado Aurora movie theater, any of these places where women were involved. Isn't it very, very, very rare to have a woman involved in this sort of activity in the United States?
Yes, it is. It absolutely is very rare. So there have been a few mass shootings, but I believe it's, you know, under 5% in the United States that involve women. A few examples, you know, unfortunately there was a faculty member at the University of Alabama, Huntsville, a different campus from mine, but still in the same state, who committed a shooting a few years ago, in a faculty meeting. And there was a shooting, in 2006 in California, by someone who had been fired, you know, a woman who had been fired, and several years later she came back and attacked the place that was her former place of employment. But yeah, culture plays a big role, and I think one of the ways to think about this is, you know, how what is the level of approval or disapproval wherever you live for the type of violence? So, unfortunately, in places like the Palestinian territories, according to Pew Research surveys, more than 60% of people in Palestine think that suicide bombings are justified. Hmm. So in that context, where more than 60% of the people approve of suicide bombings, you're going to get a wider variety of people who are willing to carry out those type of attacks. You know, fortunately, you know, everyone essentially agrees that mass shootings are bad in the United States. So you really only get the extreme fringe of people who are kind of most disturbed who engage in this type of violence.
Dr. Langford, may I ask you if you recuse or excuse the folks that are coerced or incentivized to behave in this kind of behavior? Is there a personality profile, psychological personality profile, that you found when you studied these deviant and criminal behaviors?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and you're absolutely right that the people who are coerced or pressured to do this against their will, that's kind of a different type. In terms of profile, I think what we would say is, unfortunately, there's a bit of a variety. So for the same reason that, as I referenced earlier, you know, we have 34,000 people commit suicide in this country every year, and their stories vary. Their struggles vary, their personal crises vary, and their mental health problems vary. The same thing, you know, is true with suicide terrorists. But let me give you some things that they often have in common. In many cases, there are these profound family conflicts. So there's a misnomer. There's this idea out there that, well, the families of suicide attackers or suicidal mass shooters, you know, people who are carrying out these attacks an ideology, that the families somehow support that. And it's absolutely not the case. The families, you know, are very much opposed to this, but there's often conflict in the family, sometimes death in the family, you know, divorce, abuse, trauma, all those kind of things. There's often mental illness as well, so, but that can run the gamut from depression, schizophrenia, various types of hopelessness, paranoia, bipolar, sometimes there's actually psychopathy. And then, as we mentioned, in terms of, beyond kind of the psychological problems, there are also issues of perceived victimization, where these individuals often feel like victims themselves. So, that's one of the things that makes them feel like carrying out this violence is somehow justified or acceptable, because, they feel like it's almost self-defense. You hurt me. Someone hurt me first, and now I'm responding with violence of my own. And in many cases, that sense of victimization, the sense that their attacks are justified, is a product of their mental illness as well. In other words, they have a distorted view of the world. But again, I would just add on to that. You got to do a lot of digging, to get it at the psychology of these individuals, because sometimes they can feel it. And that's a cross-cultural challenge as well. In some cultures, they're more apt to hide their mental illness or their suicidal problems than in others. And just one example from this culture, I'm sure you're familiar with the Boston Bombers, those two brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Initially after the Boston bombing, the older brother died and the younger brother was arrested. So the younger brother said, well, we were doing this because we object to American wars, American foreign policy. And for a while, the idea was, well, that just must be why they did it, because of their ideology. Fortunately, about a year later, the Boston Globe did a major investigation into their lives, and they found out that the older brother was apparently schizophrenic, that he'd been hearing voices, and that both of his parents had received psychiatric care when coming into this country. So it was only because this case got so much attention and the Boston Globe did a year-long investigation into their lives that the true psychological profile of at least that older brother actually came out.
Let me ask you, Doctor, back to the cultural question. I see that you've written an article about systematic indoctrinations in Nazi Germany, and it looks like you've compared them to Iran and Al-Qaeda and other places, other cultures. We know that after the Second World War, there was just tons of research done at places like Stanford about the indoctrination of an entire country into, there were lots of studies done on authoritarianism and how this worked to convert people in a relatively old and stable democratic society into this mass killing machine. What did you find out? What are the are there similarities, and do we need to worry about this?
Sure. So, what you're referring to is this idea, and it's absolutely concerning, that ordinary people can essentially be indoctrinated in a way that leads them to do terrible things. And as you suggested, there's research at Stanford and a variety of other places that shows that this is quite clearly the case, that ordinary people indeed can be conditioned, manipulated, indoctrinated in a way that leads them to commit violence for an organization. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. There are a number of elements to those strategies. There are a few things. One is isolation. So typically, you know, the organizations or the individuals who are trying to indoctrinate others want those people they're targeting to be isolated. They want to be the only influence on their life. And, you know, in the case of terrorists, they take them often to training camps, you know, where they can be the sole influence and begin to get their propaganda working. Dehumanization is a big part of this as well, though. And dehumanization is this idea that you get the individual to view their enemy as less than human. And that's one of the things that really facilitates violence. You know, we talked about the Charleston church shooter who could sit in the same room with these individuals who are praying for an hour and then start to shoot them. You know, what the social psychological research suggests is that that's facilitated by the strategy that he would not view them as truly human. You know, it's a breakdown of empathy or human connection. So, you know, those are a few of the things. There are a variety of other organizational strategies that are used. And of course, well, I say of course, but I assume this will be kind of common sense. Indoctrination usually works on the young most effectively. So we saw that both in Nazi Germany. We see that in Palestine. We see that in Iran and a variety of other places as well. The young are targeted when they're most impressionable, and they can really develop kind of lifelong hatreds or willingnesses to do bad things to whoever they view as the enemy.
Which is what social psychology have done over the centuries, right? With cults and those sorts of things. Dehumanize the enemy, make sure that you're isolated, keep you out of touch with reality. That's been done forever.
That kind of research, absolutely. Yeah, it's very interesting. And that's one of the reasons I say, you know, even though, as again, you know, it's no miracle cure, you know, if I was sitting in that room with this guy who carried out the attack at San Bernardino, I would want to do everything I could to humanize myself to him ahead of time, you know, break down barriers, make social connections. You know, those things make it harder for anyone to engage in violence, even though, of course, you know, there are no foolproof protection.
Well, you know, Doctor, now that you've said that, in a few minutes, the President of the United States is going to go on national television and talk about this. If we made you president for a day, what would you tell America? What can we do to humanize ourselves, to make us less of a target? Is there something we can do?
You know, the thing about, I think, fear, prejudice, dehumanization is, again, they kind of work. They work best at a distance. You know, that's the most dangerous thing. You know, when I'm sitting in my house and my imagination's running wild about what someone of another ethnicity or religion in some other house is doing, that's when, you know, my fear gets the best of me. You know, the closer we get, the more we interact, and this can be across, you know, racial lines, religious lines, you know, other political lines. You know, the more we interact, the more we start to recognize our common humanity. You know, we laugh. You know, if the room's cold, we shiver. You know, all these kind of things that we have in common. And I think that is important. So even, you know, when you look at, you know, sometimes there have been efforts to rehabilitate terrorists. You know, one of the strategies I recommend for rehabilitating terrorists is get them in the same room with the person they thought they hated, because maybe it turns out that they have more in common than you would expect. So, you know, I think there's a lot of rhetoric, you know, particularly with the presidential, you know, campaigns going on, a lot of rhetoric that's kind of aimed at creating distances and inflaming fear. And I would just say, you know, that's really negative for the country. You know, we really want to move in the opposite direction. And of course, you know, that's something that everyone can do, right? Everyone at their workplace or walking down the street can try to connect more effectively with different types of people around them. You know, I saw a something posted online of a Muslim student at a college who had a sign basically saying, you know, that he was offering free hugs to people. Yeah. You know, it's such kind of a nice thing that reminds us that, oh, wait a second, when I'm hugging this person, I realize that, you know, we're all in this together, you know, this life thing. So, you know, that's not a tactical, strategic thing, but again, it's something everyone can do.
That's well said, because I do believe, I hope this doesn't come off as totally naive, that we really have more in common with one another than what we have that is dissimilar. The human condition, as you said, some of our autonomic responses, everyone with their need to belong, wanting to be wanted, to have that human connection, that to me is prevailing over our differences.
Right, or it certainly should, or it could. I'm going to try to make my, you know, when I wake up in the morning, if I can try to make myself unhateable, that's not a bad strategy, right?
Well, you know what? This is the perfect note to end on. Let's hope that Maria's right, and that is that our common humanity will prevail. But we want to thank you so much, Dr. Lankford, for being with us tonight. I think you've really shed light on this. And I hope as things develop, we can get you to come back again as we learn more about this situation and talk more about this, because I don't think an hour quite does it. But we're going to sign off tonight with a song by the Harlem Boys Choir, Let There Be Peace on Earth, with the hope that this is the sentiment that Maria just expressed and that carries us through. Thanks again, Dr. Lankford, and we'll talk to you, America, next week.
Give the people their right to vote.